One of the, I just want to look briefly at the topic of singleness, and just mainly I'm going to talk about the experiences that I've had in counseling in that area. And of course, it's open to any discussion. In fact, I'd like you to intervene and ask questions as we go along. I see Christianity as a series of courses. That's a presupposition that I operate from. And by that I mean the day you came to Christ, you might have not known it, but He enrolled you in His school of discipleship. And that school of discipleship is tailor-made for each one of us. And as I have counseled and discipled, I know it must be up into the thousands now of people in this country and other countries, I find that God always has a purpose for the position or the situation that they're in. That really there's not anything that comes into our life that hasn't passed through His hands yet. And that every circumstance and every situation is tailor-made for that person to bring them exactly to the place where God would have them be. And so whatever our situation is, and again, that's my presupposition when I'm talking to someone, that God has them exactly where He wants them, and He has them there for a purpose and a reason. And of course, the ultimate goal and the ultimate purpose and reason is to draw nearer to Him. And He knows exactly what I need. And it may be that I need to be single and go through the struggles that are there in order to come closer to Him. And it may be that I needed to get married when I was 18 and have to struggle through that. I was sharing with the team this morning that I sometimes have a lot of fun with marriage counseling. One of the girls that was in the campus ministry when I was there got married when she was, actually I think she was about 32. And she came to me and introduced her boyfriend to me, and this was going to be the most wonderful marriage. He was the most wonderful guy she'd ever met. She told me all about him and this and that, and it went on and on and on, and she just waffled on about the guy, and I finally brought him in so I could meet him, and he went on and on about what a wonderful gal she was and how lucky they were. And I performed the marriage ceremony, and then a year later they called coming through town and wanted to see me, and they came in the office, and she sat in this corner, and he grabbed his chair and dragged it way over here and sat down. And I said, well, is this the same couple that I knew a year ago? And one of the things about this particular gal, she was always talking about herself. And I'd never known her, and I'd known her since she was 18, not to be talking about herself. And she sat down and complained about him for about 8 hours, just straight. They spent the evening with us, and the night, and I, when she left, I said, you know, it's really refreshing to hear you talk about somebody other than yourself. I mean, she really let him have it. But what could the purpose in singleness be? And I'd like to look at just a few of those purposes. And I really want you to see that the Lord has His hand on the situation that you're in. That you're not in it for no reason at all. And to me, here's one of the most exciting things about being single. And how many were there last night at this session that we went over? Okay. So this would be new to some of you. But I want to apply it in a little different way because I didn't get to say this. In Genesis, we're told that God created man. And the word there in the Hebrew is singular. He created man, and He tells us his name was Adam. Adam was, in one body, a male and a female. He had the characteristics of both in his body. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't maybe look like a man outwardly, but inwardly, he had both of these characteristics. He was complete. So God set out to find a mate for Adam, and he couldn't find anybody because Adam was complete. So he did the next thing that seems logical, and that is that he took out of Adam the female And now she could be his mate and they could be one. But as soon as God took the female out of Adam, Adam stopped being a man and became a male. You with me? Man is singular. So as soon as female is taken out of him, he's a male now. He's not a man any longer. And then we're told right after that, and God created man, he says the same thing a second time, singular, male plus a female. So one man is a male and a female. That's one man. That's one life. I said to the gal last night, the proof that you and your husband are one is that you make each other miserable. That's proof that you are one. So they become one. Now, Satan understood this because he went to God and he said, let me destroy Job. Remember that? And he said, you can do whatever you want to Job, but you can't take his life. So he took his crops and his flocks and his home and his children and his health. But what didn't he take? His wife. Because even Satan knew that Job's wife was his life. He couldn't touch her because the two had become one flesh. They were one. Now, here's the exciting thing to me about being single. And you can find this principle, especially at work, in a widow. And they're the ones that can often relate this to you most accurately. But here is a woman who has lived her whole life as a male and a female, as one man, as one flesh. And all of a sudden, her husband dies. And what these women will tell you is, the Lord moved in and took over that part of their life, that responsibility. That God actually moved into there and they have come to know God in a way that they could have never known Him before. And of course, that's what Paul says. If you're going to be single, you have to have a gift. And I believe that as we are single, and this applies mainly to out of the home, that God gives us a special dispensation of His Spirit and His life to know Him in a way that others may not. It's just a deeper knowledge of Him. So it's really exciting to be able to experience that. To have God's life in a way you've never had it. You gals were created to have a man to watch over you. And if you don't have one, you're going to have the unique experience of allowing God to be the one who watches over you. It's a great place to be. And in fact, I've known some people who have entered into this and understood this and grasped it that really didn't want to get married when they had the opportunity because they were afraid they were going to lose it. Now, here's the next question. I'm kind of making an absolute statement here. I'm saying that if you're single, God is moving in to fill up in you what's lacking, and you can know the Lord in ways that I can't know Him. He can meet needs in you that my wife is needing, and that's a unique experience for you. So here's the next question. How come you don't experience it? Was that a good question or am I? Why aren't we experiencing it? Now there's one of the things that we won't probably have a chance. All this keeps tying in together. I don't have a notebook with me. We have a notebook? Or the one that I had from the conference? Thanks. Okay, why do you think people don't experience that? Instead, they experience what? What do you normally experience as a single? Loneliness. Now, there's some issues in that and some reality, but ultimately, Paul could be in prison all by himself, chained to the wall, and he wasn't lonely. Why aren't we experiencing this deeper experience of the Lord of being single? How come I'm not having that? Anybody got any ideas?
Because concentrated so much on fulfilling that one need that it takes over your life.
Okay.
So what we perceive as a need.
Okay. And that's a good point. What do we think we're going to get out of a mate if we find one? Okay, purpose. What else? Somebody else give us some ideas.
Fulfillment.
Okay, fulfillment. Have a companion. Yeah, love. And don't you think...
You don't have to struggle anymore with physical desires.
Okay. Okay. You got no struggle. And what do people, and I'm not so sure that people really tell us this, but we all have what I call emotional filtering. So somebody can say A to us and we hear B. And that emotional filtering is awfully handy for the enemy to use. Because he loves to whisper things. And remember, Satan will always speak to you with a first-person singular voice and an Oklahoma accent. And if I'm single long enough, he's going to stand behind me in that first-person singular voice, and I'll promise you he'll say this, I am worthless. Or, I am unacceptable. Anybody ever heard that? Nobody wants me. It really is an issue that begins to deal with my real worth. Now, you know, I look at people that are single, and there's been many days I've thought, boy, are they lucky. Yeah, those kind of thoughts, honestly, have never entered my mind. But yet, the enemy can be doing those kind of things to us all the time. And it becomes a worth issue, and we can live under the delusion or deception that a person could meet that in me, when really God wants to meet it in me. Now, for some reason, those of you that aren't married today are special. And I don't know what's special about you. But for some reason, the Lord wants you to have a deeper walk with Him before you get married than He allowed me to have. I don't get it. I mean, I don't understand how God chooses people. I can't get that through my head. I was telling a story of being in India and speaking three times a day, traveling. I'd been 10 weeks out of town. I was totally exhausted, going from one place to the next, to the next, to the next. I didn't have time for anything, and a fellow comes to me and says, would you counsel a Indian girl this afternoon? Well, I'd been up at, flying in and out of Delhi, been up at 2 every morning and getting to bed at midnight. And I had that afternoon slotted to sleep. And I really sensed the Lord saying, no, you go talk to her. That's the only reason you're on this trip. Now, I've learned since then, if you find the lowliest person, that's who God sent you to. His standard of who He wants to deal with is totally different than the world's. And He really laid on my heart, this whole trip is for this girl, you go. Well, I was exhausted, and I'd worked a lot, and I said, the whole trip's for this girl, I got to meet her. So I said, yeah, I'll see her. And I went walking into the room, and she wouldn't look up at me. She was deformed, had all kinds of physical problems and ailments, and she wouldn't even look at me, and she was a dark-skinned Indian. And when I sat down, she slid a piece of paper toward me, and I picked it up, and it was entitled, How to Live Your Life, How I'll Live My Life. And she was so worthless and so unacceptable, and of course in India to have a daughter like that, it's a curse because you can't marry her off, and you're just stuck with her. And her parents always told her she was a curse. And so what she would do is stay in her room and sleep in the daytime. I'll do all the housework at night and be quiet so I don't bother anyone. She left the house going in and out the rear window. And when she was walking down the street and saw a light-skinned Indian come towards her, she would cross over. If she was in a store buying something and light-skinned Indians came in, she would go to the back till everyone else was gone, because she was worthless and no good and unacceptable. And then she said, "I'll wait for death." That was the last thing she said. And I spoke to her, and of course she wouldn't even look at me. And I raised her chin up and I said, "If you're so worthless, why did God send me 12,000 miles for you?" Isn't it amazing how God sees things? He looks down and he sees this hurting person, and God's economy is not our economy. He doesn't care how much he has to spend to get to that hurting person. He doesn't care how much work has to be done. Your cries are never unheard by him. I promise you that. Whatever it takes, when he's ready to answer, he'll answer. Now, what made that girl so special to the Lord? And to this day, I believe I would have been better off just to fly over and see her and go home. That's where he wanted me. What made her so special that he's pulling her out? She doesn't look too special to anyone else. Why is it that today you're single and maybe you don't want to be? But the real issue isn't even that. What I'd really like to know that baffles me is how come you have the opportunity to know God in this deep way and I never did? What is it about you that makes you so special? Well, I don't know. I can't sort it all out. But that's where you're at. Now, the real question right now isn't if you're single. The real question I'd like to propose is this: are you seizing the opportunity to experience this? Because believe me, if you don't want to be single, God hasn't given you the gift to be single, and someday you'll be married. So that's coming. That's not an issue. That'll happen. I've seen it happen hundreds of times. What I want to know, though, is have you seized this opportunity? Because you have a tremendous chance to know him in a way no one else does, with no distractions, meeting needs that no one else has ever experienced. And I can bring people in here to you who have experienced that. One of my best friends from England is 64 and never been married. Scott knows him, Eric Madison. And he is just full of life. The guy bounces when he walks. He's just full of joy. And he said that when he was 22, he was praying about which of these two women he ought to marry. And the Lord spoke to him and said, "You won't marry anyone. You'll walk alone, but never be alone." And he said, "I've never been alone, and my joy has been full and complete," because he was able to experience this. So we ought to be experiencing that in the midst of it and be filled with joy. Okay, again, back to my question. If we haven't seized that opportunity, and I don't know anyone in this room, so you might have and you might have not. But if you haven't seized it, the question that comes to my mind right away is, why not? You have an opportunity that few have. A lady came to me and her husband had died, and she hadn't seized the opportunity. And was really upset, and I asked her why she came, and she said, "Well, my husband died 3 months ago, and I haven't got over it yet." And I said, "Well, get out of here. I mean, how do you get over something like that in 3 months? That's ridiculous. Who told you that?" Well, some Christian told her she should have been full of joy and happiness, you know, because she had Jesus, even though her husband died, you know, just ridiculous. But that wasn't the real issue. She wasn't seizing this, which she needed right then. The potential for that and the opportunity for it. And I think the reason many of us don't seize that and we're driven to continue to look for the person that'll do this for us is because we don't really want God in there. Now, I'll repeat and repeat for some of you. This wasn't on my notes, but I'm gonna do it anyway. Everybody get a piece of paper and let me give you a test and see if we can maybe discern. Now, this isn't a test that you can flunk. Okay, you don't have to worry about that. Anybody need pens, paper? Okay. Oh, there's some right over there. That paper. Dig in. Dig in. Any more pens? Need a piece of paper down? Somebody got an extra one?
I think we got one here.
Okay. Okay, I want to give you a test. Some of you have taken this, and that's you'll just have to suffer through it the second time. And I want you to answer these questions, not on the basis of how you think, but how you feel. And I want you to answer it how you feel at your very worst moment. All right? It's not a Bible quiz. I don't want to know your head knowledge. I want to know how you feel down here in your gut. At your very worst moment, how would you answer this? Let me give you an example. If I ask one question, when I think about God, I feel. And this missionary told me love. And I said, yeah, I learned that in Bible college too. But what do you feel at your worst moment? And he said, well, God's an SOB. There's a big difference between what he thought and what he felt. Now, you don't have to write a bunch of curse words on here. That's not what I'm telling you. I just want you to be honest and write down how you feel, and I want it to be the first thought that comes into your mind. We don't have to take a lot of time with this. Okay, we're not going to give you much time. I'm going to read through them, and you write down your answer. When I think about being with God, I feel... When I have to trust God, I feel... When I think about God, I wish. Sometimes I get angry with God when... It frustrates me when God wants me to. I really enjoy God when... The one thing I would change about myself to please God is... When I think about God's commandments, I feel... Sometimes I wish God would I can really depend on God when in my relationship with God, am I sure that He will? The one thing that frightens me about God is God surprises me when and the one thing I'm afraid God will do is Okay, let's look at that for a minute. What I call this, and Scott has developed an excellent booklet on this that really deals with it in detail. I'd suggest that you get it if you're interested. But what we're looking at is, who do you feel God is? Now, as I said, you have an opportunity that few have. I want to make sure you're seizing it. If you have seized that opportunity, that's fine. If you haven't, I want to know why. For most of us, with our mind, we run to God, but with our emotions, we're running away. And those two collide, and they give me a lot of turmoil. I mean, I know I ought to run to God, but for some reason, there's something down here that doesn't allow me. And ultimately, I found those who have seized that opportunity have found that these needs were met in Him. They were able to have those needs met in Christ. Now, intellectually, we all know that, but emotionally, I'm not so sure that we feel it. And how do you think most people operate out of what they think or what they feel? Yeah, what they feel. Now, I've given this thing I don't know how many times. Here's basically the answers that I get, and these don't have to be yours. But when I think about being with God, I feel alone. That He's not there. When I have to trust God, I feel He will not come through. Or He will make me wait. And I'm not going to get anything right away. When I think about God, I wish that He would help me. I wish that He was there. I wish He would hear me. Now, if you wish that He'd hear you, that's probably saying that He doesn't. Sometimes I get angry with God when He makes me do something that'll make me miserable. So He gives His actions cause misery. It frustrates me when God wants me to do something I can't. I really enjoy God when He helps, when He's there, when He hears me, when He acts. If that's really when you really enjoy Him and you don't have a lot of joy, it probably says that He doesn't help, doesn't act, or doesn't hear you. The one thing that I would change about myself to please God is everything. Just start at the bottom and work up. Some kind of an answer that would basically say this. I need to do more to be acceptable to Him. When I think about God's commandments, I feel judgment or unacceptable, or I may even feel like I'm a failure. Sometimes I wish God would, this is a good one, take me home. If I want God to take me home, what's that tell me about this wonderful Christian life I received? It's really pretty miserable. People tell me I've accepted Christ, everything would be wonderful, but I'm really saying that life is miserable. I can depend on God when, and I may say, really for nothing, it's up to me. If it's going to get done, I've got to do it. Or I can depend on Him when all else fails. Or I can depend on Him when I'm at the absolute bottom, He'll finally act and do something for me. In my relationship with God, I'm always sure that He'll get me, He'll reveal me, He'll let others know about my failures, He'll let others know that I'm unacceptable. He'll reveal my failure. The one thing that frightens me about God is judgment. Have I done enough? Will He ever help me? Will He be there? He surprises me when He helps. The one thing I'm afraid God will do is make me stay single. Allow me to go on suffering. Or maybe take somebody in my family. Basically, again, not help. Now, I'm not saying that you have to have all of those things. You might not have all of them. You might have. Can you relate to what I'm saying, though? That's the... Did you find in your list some of these things? Okay. Now, just imagine, again, that you're at a crusade, and the guy says, come forward and accept Christ. And from this day forward, if you have Jesus in your heart, you'll be alone. He won't be there. He'll never come through. He'll make you wait. He won't help you. He won't hear you. He'll cause you misery. You'll be unacceptable. You'll walk in judgment, failure. Your life will be miserable. And He'll reveal what a mess you are to everyone else. Would the ushers please come forward? Would you go forward? Now, here's the thing. For the single person, that's exciting. I mean, I think it's neat. Here you are, a little branch in this vase. And you're all by yourself. You don't have any life within yourself. When you cut off a branch and put it in a vase, it starts dying the minute it's in there. It doesn't have life within. And try as it may, it cannot get any life. It's got to have life. So you know what most people do then? They take this dead branch and they graft it to another dead branch and kind of tape the thing together and hope that this dead branch can give it some of its dead life. Now that describes 99% of the marriages in the United States today. I'm in here dying. I don't have the things I need within, which are love, acceptance, assurance, security, hope, purpose. So I'll just graft into another dead branch called my wife or my husband, and I'll try to suck the little bit of life that they have out of them into me. Now that's got to be a dead-end street. That's not going anywhere. You can't milk life out of something that's dead. What God has done for you is He's taken the true vine that's full of life and grafted you into it. You're there in Him. And as He grafts you in, this life flows into you that has purpose, it has hope, it can endure, it's full of love, acceptance, security, assurance. And not only that, one thing that we'd all like to have is that it's full of total commitment to you. Now, there's a little door right here. And often, if this is your concept of what that life is, not this. Now, I can tell you this and it appeals to your mind and you say, yeah, I understand that. He could prove that in the Bible. That is, you already knew that in your mind. I haven't told you anything new. This is what would actually come in because this is reality. But instead, if you feel this is what's going to come in, you're going to stand on this door with both feet, yelling and screaming and saying, don't let it in. And you're going like this with God. Come here, but stay away. I'm in conflict. And you're not experiencing the unique experience that you can have of having the Lord's life fill that up in you. Are you tracking with me? Okay, now, who is this? Get your list out and look at it and tell me who it is.
Satan.
Okay, Satan would be one answer.
Mom or dad.
Okay. All right. Those are the answers we get, and usually, and if you just get your list out, because I want you to read through this with me and look at it. I want to see if we can find out who it is. Here's the first person I start with. Did he hold you in his lap? Did he ever kiss you? Did he ever make you feel like you were somebody? Was he there for you? Would he come through? Did he make you wait and not come through on his promises? Just sort of unending and never seemed to happen. Could you really count on him to help you? Did he hear you? Did he ever sit down and talk with you? Did he ever take time for you? Did his actions ever cause you misery? You know, you take a gal who has been sexually molested by her father on earth and then tell her to pray to her father in heaven and see what that does to her guts. Did his actions ever cause misery? Did you feel unacceptable? No matter how much you did, you need to go one step further. No matter how much you performed, it was never high enough. You need to do a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. You're never acceptable. Did you sense judgment? Either covertly or overtly, either you were told that or you just sensed it, you weren't quite good enough. Did you feel like you're a failure, that you should have performed, that you should have done better? You have that brother or sister that's married to the doctor or the lawyer, and they're so much better off. They had the good marriage, everything worked out for them. Now, they've done studies that prove that by age 7, your concept of authority is fixed. And where do you suppose you get a concept of authority? From the authorities you grew up with. That's normal for you. And you'll either find that this is generally, I find, it's either dad, or it's mom, or it's a combination, or it's the people at the children's home. It doesn't matter who it is. It's some authority in my life that has given me this kind of a concept, and that's in my gut, and I haven't been able to shake it yet. And therefore, the very God that ought to meet my need and make my life abundant isn't able to meet it because I keep the door shut every day. Now, I'll give you a little assignment that you can do. In 1 Corinthians 13, 1 John 4:8 says God is love. Well, if God is love, then 1 Corinthians 13 describes Him. And I'd like you to go through that chapter, and everywhere the word love appears, write God. And so instead of love is patient, I'd like you to write out God is patient, and then go to any dictionary and look up patience and find out what that is. God is patient. God is kind. God is long-suffering. And God will bear with you, believe in you, hope in you, endure with you. He hates all unrighteousness that happened to you. He's always there for you. Now, of course, what do you think? Your mind says this, or your mind will say that God's this. Your emotions say this. If you wait for your emotions to line up with your thinking, how long will you wait? Forever. You've got to begin to act. You know, I always just felt condemned by God, unacceptable. I never did enough until finally one day I said, Lord, if I'm as bad as I feel, you kill me by lunch. But if you don't kill me by lunch, I'm going to go ahead and live as though you love me and you accept me and you care for me and you're there. And believe me, when you begin to live in that, and this God, 1 Corinthians 13, comes to the forefront, all other issues in your life will disappear. See, we can have two issues. On this hand, we've got I'm single. On this hand, I've got the Lord. As long as I focus on being single, the Lord disappears. And it's burdensome and it's vexing. But as soon as the Lord comes to the forefront, being single just fades away. It's not an issue. And not only that, I know the Lord in a deep way that very few have the opportunity to know Him. I'm able to spend time with Him. Now, I believe that's the course that He has every single person in. I don't know why you were lucky enough to get chosen for that course. Because the majority of Christians, God is perfectly content to allow to go their own way and not have anything at all to do with them. And I believe that those of you that are single today, if you had a mate today, you wouldn't be struggling or seeking the Lord in the way you are now. He set this circumstance up so you'll draw near to Him. The issue is you got to get through the course. You need to pass the course. You need to draw near to Him. You need to learn what's to be learned out of this. Now the other thing, and well, I got 2 minutes and I'll quit. The other thing that's to be learned, and I found this often to be true, that the single person who, say, has waited for a mate, there's some that God hasn't called to marriage, there's some that He has, will be great people of faith. In the Old Testament, the word faith appears one time, but the word wait appears 238 times. See, the greatness of your faith is never measured by what you receive, but greatness of faith is measured by how long you can wait. You want me to say that again? Greatness of faith is never measured by what you've received, it's measured by how long you can wait. Now, you look at the saints of old, all those who were able to wait were the greatest men. And so it's in your ability to wait on the Lord. If He's put the desire in your heart to be married, He's going to fulfill that desire. I promise you He will. But as you wait, you will become a person of faith. And see, today we're taught by faith teachers that I have the most faith because I prayed for a Mercedes-Benz last night and it appeared in the driveway. But if you judge his faith by his ability to wait, that guy is peanuts. He's nowhere. And the person who's had to wait on the Lord to act will be the person who has the most faith. And they'll be used most of the Lord.